in the case of United States against Williams.
May it please the court.
May
it please the court, counsel. Mark Spillin, appointed counsel for Mr. Williams in the case of United States versus Williams. Mr. Williams' appeal presents several issues, and with the court's indulgence, I would like to address the second issue raised in the brief as my first portion of argument this morning. But in brief summary, permit me to remind the court that Mr. Williams was convicted following a jury trial of one count of conspiracy, possessing with intent to distribute more than 50 grams of cocaine base or crack cocaine, several substantive counts of distribution and or possession of controlled substance, and one count of being a felon in possession of a firearm. He was acquitted or found not guilty of two substantive counts regarding distribution or possession. Following those convictions, the district court imposed a sentence of life on count one, the conspiracy count, 360 months in prison on counts 2, 5, and 6, and 120 months on count 7, and all those sentences concurrent with one another. Perhaps the most troubling aspect of the sentencing in this case is the district court's failure to follow Title 21, Section 851B. Clearly, the obligation is on the district court when an enhancement information is filed by the government to inquire of the defendant whether he or she challenges the alleged criminal history presented to the district court. I believe it's not disputed that the district court in this case did not inquire of Mr. Williams whether or not he challenged his prior conviction. And in that sense, I think it's not contested that there was an error. And in that sense, I think it's not contested that that error was clear or obvious, at least at this stage. Suppose the argument comes down to, or the question comes down to, so what? The defendant suggests that so what is a significant so what. It is clear from the sentencing transcript that the district court judge felt that in light of Mr. Williams' criminal history, the court had no discretion, in fact, deemed the life sentence mandatory concerning count one, and therefore imposed a sentence of life imprisonment on count one. And as this court is well, of course, the fact that there may be concurrent sentences
But if count one were vacated, would anything happen other than the $100 special assessment? Given the substantive convictions, which could then be run consecutively to produce a life sentence, or I guess they could be run consecutively to produce, what, six life sentences?
I believe that's correct, yes.
Almost two-thirds of a cat. What does count one really do? Why does it matter?
Well, it's precisely because that question is raised and we don't know the answer that it should be sent to the district court, so we do know the answer to that. We do not know, nor are we in a position, I suggest, to second-guess the district court having said, well, I have no discretion. It's a mandatory life sentence imposed. We don't know. And it's because we don't know that I suggest, the defendant suggests, that the appropriate remedy, at least concerning the sentence on that count, is to remand. Give the defendant the opportunity to challenge his prior history as set forth in the government's enhancement information. Who knows? Maybe there's a basis to challenge them. Maybe there isn't. Unfortunately, we don't know the answer to those questions.
Why don't you know the answer to those questions? And your client knows what his convictions are. You could do the research and tell us whether there's a basis. Is there any basis?
Not that's in the record before, that was before the district court, or that's in the record before this court today.
So, what difference does it make? It's another variation of the what difference question.
Again, Your Honor,
if even now, with the assistance of a skilled advocate, there's no basis for doubting the propriety of the enhancement substantively, what could your client have said on his feet that you can't say now?
Your Honor, I don't mean to suggest that there is no basis to challenge them. I meant to suggest and reiterate that there is nothing I can point to in the record, given the way this transpired, that would be a clear and definitive answer to you to say, I can answer the what if, because I can tell you, for example, that he wasn't represented by counsel in one of the prior convictions. I mean, facially, the documents presented to the district court and given to the defendant and defense counsel would appear to substantiate a finding or determination, if challenged by the defendant, that in fact those two convictions were valid, appropriate, not constitutionally infirm. And I
wouldn't actually make any difference under Lewis, even if they were constitutionally infirm. The only thing that would make a difference is that if they'd been previously set aside, right? And one could look up and see whether a collateral attack had been filed, or one of those convictions had been set aside, or annulled, or pardoned, or something like that.
And I will say to the court, that to my knowledge, although this goes outside the record before the district court, that there is no indication of just that type of factual information.
Okay.
At the risk of repeating myself, that the concern here is that when the obligation and requirement is squarely placed on a district court to suggest, as the government does, that it's the defendant's fault for not challenging his criminal history, I think begs the question. The defense submits that 851 is set up in the manner in which it is, especially Part B, to avoid, hopefully, just this type of situation. And especially when the district court's mindset is it's a mandatory life sentence. Regarding the next point, the first point actually raised in the brief, and that is insufficient.
How do you suggest the procedure should have happened?
District court at perhaps that sentencing, but certainly prior to imposition of sentence, should have inquired of the defendant, I suggest, essentially a series of questions along these lines. You acknowledge receipt of the enhancement information filed by the government. You've reviewed it. You have any questions? Do you wish to challenge in any respect either of those convictions set forth? I'm paraphrasing, of course, but through that give and take, a defendant would have an option to say, I've got no basis to do so. I was represented by counsel. I understood my rights. Those have not been overturned or reversed prior to my standing here before you, Your Honor. I've got no legal challenge to those convictions, and sentencing would proceed.
You're not contending you wasn't aware of the that the pre-sentence report and had that information in it?
We are not suggesting that he did not have the information or was not aware of the enhanced penalty being sought by the government. In sum, the other two points are set forth in the brief, but in summary fashion they are as follows. The evidence against Mr. Williams at trial, we would acknowledge, indicates an active participation in the sale of narcotics. We submit that while that may be the case, that does not constitute a conspiracy, certainly does not constitute the conspiracy that he was charged with, in light of the fact that Mr. Walton, one of the named but unindicted co-conspirators, indicated that he never saw Williams and LeSueur working together. He didn't sell any to him. The most troubling aspect, I suppose,
does this matter? Back to my original question, I suppose. Are we arguing about more than the $100 special assessment here, given all the other convictions?
I submit yes, Your Honor. I submit that while in the final wash, the result may well be the same.
Has your client, by the way, paid the $100 special assessment on the conspiracy conviction?
I must confess I'm unable to answer that question this morning, Your Honor.
Because if he hadn't paid it, it's not clear that it matters even to the special assessment. Although it would be a debt hanging over his head, not dischargeable in bankruptcy.
And the point that the defense would make is that while in the final wash, we may end up well where we are now, that the system, and when the statute imposes such a clear obligation on the district court, it behooves us all that obligation be followed, even if the end result is the same as it is currently.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Swan. Mr. Moore.
Thank you. If it pleases the court, for the counsel, let me address the question of the 851. As counsel has noted, the 851 enhancement was set forth in the PSR, and in fact, in his brief, he acknowledges that the defendant filed an objection to the 851 enhancement information, but it wasn't an objection that dealt with the substance of the 851. It was really an objection about the assistance or the quality of assistance he'd gotten from his prior attorney. He said, if I had known that this 851 enhancement was going to subject me to a life term, I would have pled guilty. So that he's clearly on notice with regards to the existence of the 851 enhancement and its contents prior to sentencing. Judge Gilbert says at sentencing,
I'm a little puzzled by the actual term of the sentence. Why was the life sentence imposed only on
three strikes? He had two prior drug felonies, and this was a third crack cocaine.
I understand that. So why wasn't he sentenced to life imprisonment on each of counts 1 to 6?
The other substantive counts were for distribution of less than 5 grams, which does not carry the life sentence.
Less than five grams.
20 enhanced to 30.
So it was less than 5 grams per count.
That's right, for the substantive distributions. And then he also had a gun charge, which carried a maximum of 10 years. Judge Gilbert says at sentencing, he says, you have filed this objection to the 851 enhancement. That says that you're not satisfied to your about the quality of the assistance you've had on your prior attorney. You've got a new attorney. Do you have any other objections? He says no. His new attorney gets up and says, no, I don't have any other objections. So clearly there's an opportunity for him to contest the substance of the 851 enhancement. And the convictions which are set out and appended to the 851 enhancement are certified. They show his social security number. They show his date of birth. They show his description. They show his name. And in fact, they are identical, with the exception of one of them leaves out a middle initial, which I think has no legal significance. To the name and identifier set out in the PSR. So there is no substantive argument that he's not actually good for those two convictions which resulted in the imposition of the mandatory life sentence. Counsel then goes on to raise the issue of sufficiency of proof with regard to conspiracy, and as I've noted, there was no motion at the close of the all the evidence preserving this, so this is a plain error question. But the proof, even if it wasn't a plain error question, the proof shows that from 1995 through 1999, Mr. LeSure and Mr. Williams, the defendant here, were involved in an ongoing and extended period of time, and Mr. Walton was supplying Mr. LeSure, and Mr. LeSure said that when he testified, Mr. Walton was getting us our crack, and we were selling it together. And there were no less than, I think, a dozen other witnesses that established that they were involved over an extended period of time in the sale of crack in the Mount Vernon area. There was a standardized practice of combining money, usually $3,500 a crack, between the two, Mr. LeSure and Mr. Williams, and it is clear, too, that there was the level of trust required by case law to show conspiracy in that LeSure and Williams actually lived together. They did business for an extended period of time, and even when Mr. LeSure goes off and he's significantly ill, Mr. Williams continues to do the business and make sure that Mr. LeSure continues to get his money. And it is, I don't think that counsel really spoke too much about the third issue that they raised, and that was the use of the proffer and rebuttal, and I think the briefs adequately cover that. If there are any questions, I'm happy to answer them. Otherwise, I'll sit down. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Anything further, Mr. Stwan?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Mr. Stwan, we appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment. An unusual position for you, is it not? And the assistance you've been to the court on behalf of a criminal defendant this time. Thank you very much. We have not